Welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Megan Kamrick. Last week, in a special session of the New Mexico legislature, lawmakers moved to legalize recreational cannabis, and Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham is expected to sign the legislation. The changes allow individuals to grow for personal use or to sell with a micro business license, and they create a structure that will gradually increase taxes over time. A separate bill allows for the expungement of criminal records for some past marijuana offenses. Supporters hail the passage as a way to diversify New Mexico's economy, bring in tax income, and address inequities left by the war on drugs. But opponents worry about the unintended consequences of the new industry and the costs. This morning on Let's Talk New Mexico, we'll look at what the legislation contains, how it structures legalization, and the timeline. We'll talk to lawmakers, regulators, and advocates. What questions do you have? Are you excited about legal cannabis? Are you concerned about what it means for New Mexico? Email letstalk@kunm.org. Tweet to us using the hashtag letstalknm or call 505-277-5866. My first guest is Andy Lyman, a reporter with New Mexico Political Report. He's been reporting on the state's medical cannabis program for years, and he and I co-host the podcast Growing Forward, Cannabis and New Mexico on New Mexico PBS. We launched it last fall with a grant from the New Mexico Local News Fund. We've been exploring the growth of the state's medical cannabis program, the players in the industry, and how legalization might impact the state. You can find that at nmpbs.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Andy, let's give a quick recap. The bills to legalize failed to pass in the regular session. The governor called a special session to focus mostly on this. What were some of the biggest sticking points that resulted in the initial failure, and how did things shift so that the bills were able to pass in the special session?
Well, I think there was a number of things that sort of, it's a very comprehensive approach. And so I think there's a lot of issues that people or lawmakers sort of had questions or had concern with. But I think some of the bigger ones were, you know, control of production for producers. There were some other issues with whether this is going to give an upper hand to some of the bigger companies that are already in existence. But I think through lots of sort of compromise and I think they did find a pretty good middle ground there as far as controlling production for a period of time.
And that was to let newcomers or smaller businesses get a foot in the market, right?
Yeah. So essentially, as the bill stands now and as it'll be signed, there is a plant count there's not a plant count in the law, but it allows regulation and licensing department to implement some sort of control on production there for a period of time. And that, as in legislative speak, has a sunset, I think 2026. And yes, that was to give people a chance to sort of even the playing fields, because there are producers out there that could have resources to grow unlimited amounts and really get out of the gate quickly. So that was sort of an evening for folks wanting to get into it.
How did these issues fall along party lines?
I saw a difference between the House and the Senate, and I think maybe that has to do with the fact that in the Senate there was Senator Cliff Pirtle, who he's a Republican from Roswell, had his own version and sort of tried to push more of a free market approach to it. So in the House, there was ultimately Republicans mostly voted. I mean, all voted against this proposal in the special session. But I think in the Senate, there was some support for Senator Cliff Pirtle's bill.
You and I interviewed former Governor Gary Johnson earlier this week, perhaps the most well-known proponent of legalization starting at least two decades ago. What were some of his main takes on how this finally came about?
He does have sort of a free market approach, and he didn't really get into that when we talked to him that deeply. But he has told me in another interview that, you know, he sort of favors this, you know, sort of open grow and also favors less barriers to get into the industry. But so he had praise for the bill as it stands now, that the costs are low for some of the folks that want to be a smaller producer or micro business. But I think he sort of is taking some credit for being an advocate for this a long time ago, but he's also praising everyone who got it done this special session.
Let's remind listeners, the majority of states that have legalized so far have done it through voter referenda, not through this kind of really intensive debate in the legislative process, which we saw in the session and in the special session. Why didn't New Mexico go that route, and what did that mean for getting a legalization bill done?
It's sort of a complicated answer, but I'll try to shorten it up. Number one, we don't really have that provision. We don't have a way for voters. We have a constitutional amendment process, which allows voters to weigh in on this, but that process is really long, and the unintended consequence of that is it becomes part of our constitution. So it's a little bit more complicated to do things that way. Secondly, if they did do it that way, they'd have to come back and do exactly what they did in the special session and sort of craft a law around that. And that takes some time. And also this was a way to sort of address all those things. Even if we had a voter referendum process, it would be really, really difficult to get all of those things into that. You know, Arizona did it through a voting process, and it was long. There was a lot of stuff in there, but it did not address any of the things that the bill waiting for the signature does.
And we do have a call right now from Bill in Los Lunas. Bill, what did you want to say?
Yes, good morning. I prefer industries that make their profit here in New Mexico, and their bottom line profit stays here in New Mexico and circulates and circulates and circulates through New Mexico. Bad industries that are bad for New Mexico are like the dollar stores, box stores, whose bottom line goes to Texas and circulates over there, and we never see any of that bottom line ever again in New Mexico. Those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Andy, I think that was a big part of the debate that we saw is interesting. I saw people on the left side of the spectrum, the right side, it's like, how are we going to make sure this doesn't benefit big out-of-state companies to come in and take advantage of those?
It sort of reminds me of a conversation we had with Natalie Furtig of Politico. It's not exactly the same, but she was talking about trying to sort of add a socialism type provision into a capitalist society. And I think just to kind of address that, the issue that Bill just brought up was, I think that New Mexicans feel that way about every industry. And you know, we saw that in the liquor license change where this new license type can sell spirits, but it has to be New Mexico spirits. So I don't think that anybody would disagree that we want to try to keep the money inside. But then, you know, sort of we have a system that in general doesn't prevent outside companies from coming in.
And I will say, to Bill's point, I used to be a business reporter. There are plenty of good economic studies that show that when you have businesses based in a state or in a community, the tax dollars turnover stay in the community much more than if it's an out-of-state company. So he is right in that respect. We also have an email question from Ken. He asks, on what date does simple possession become legal once the governor signs? This is a good opportunity for me to introduce Linda Trujillo. She's a former lawmaker and now the superintendent of the Regulation and Licensing Department, which will be the main oversight agency for cannabis in the state. Superintendent Trujillo, can you answer Ken's question?
Good morning, everybody. Yes, that is a really important question, so I'm glad that it was asked. The date that simple possession will be legal is not until June 29th. There was not an emergency clause on this act, and there, quite frankly, wasn't enough votes for an emergency clause to have been voted in. So once the bill is signed by the governor, there is still a 90-day delay from the time the last day of the special session, which the date we've counted is June 29th.
And when we say June 29th, possession becomes legal, what does that mean? Does that mean anyone can just go sit in a park and bring out their bong and smoke to abandon oblivion?
No, that is not going to even be the case under the law, even once it becomes legal, because public smoking is not allowed in public places, even once the law is effective. So it means that you could hold on your person, in your vehicle, you know, with yourself, you could hold up to the limit of cannabis once June 28th hits. You could partake, smoke it in your home, in your, you know, keeping in mind that, and we can talk about growing later, but you'll be able to smoke that in non-public places.
And what is the limit of amount? What amount can you have on your person legally?
So that is a really good question. And it took us a lot of time to really kind of look through that and figure out, like, what's the medium in other states? There's a couple of states that don't have any limits. There's other states that have much more aggressive limits. So we came up with, we started with 2 ounces of cannabis and 16 grams of extract, and then had a discussion that, you know, if somebody goes into a cannabis retail store and purchases cannabis, it's highly probable that they'll also be purchasing edibles. And so we added in 800 milligrams of edibles. So those are the limits, right? 2, 16, and 800.
We also have an email from Wendy in Las Vegas, New Mexico. She lived in Colorado and worked for a company with branches in many states. And in terms of marijuana, they had to comply with federal regulations. With legal cannabis, they had great difficulty hiring people who could pass the required drug screening. I don't know if that falls under your purview, Superintendent, but these are the kind of issues that are going to come up, right? We have a lot of people who work for federal contractors here.
Yeah, no, thank you for that question. So we are going to have responsibility to oversee the individuals who work in those facilities. And the background check is going to be a little bit different here. Now, I can't speak to, you know, federal oversight of that. That's kind of out of our purview. But certainly we have the Expungement Act. And so anyone who's got a prior cannabis, marijuana conviction, that has the ability to be expunged, but it also will not be the consideration in employment or business owner under the New Mexico law.
And we will talk expungement later on in the show because that was actually broken out into a separate bill. Andy, did you want to add something?
No, I just had a question for the superintendent. Going back to an issue just two issues ago was the possession and buying. I know there was a question of an and versus an or that was, and when it comes to can you have this plus this plus this, can you talk about the intention of the law there just so folks know what they can and can't possess at one time?
Yep, certainly. So throughout the bill, the and is the purchasing and holding. Once it gets up to the any penalties, as long as it's a misdemeanor, the word and is still there. So anything over 2 ounces, 16 grams, and 800 milligrams is still an and. But once it gets up to like 32 ounces, it becomes or 32 ounces or, oh, and I need to do the math. I'm going to have to look that up, Andy, but it's an extreme amount. It was like 3,200 milligrams of edibles, which if anybody has purchased edibles or knows how much is in an edible, 3,200 milligrams of edibles is a lot of edibles. And so once it gets up to that felony conviction, potentially it's or. So anything below that is and what you can carry on your possession and purchase is and.
We need to go to a quick break. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. We'll be back in a moment.
Joachim Prince was a rabbi and a lifelong advocate of human rights through the Second World War and the American Civil Rights Movement. He once said, "The most tragic problem is silence." Coming up, it's a piece called "I Will Not Remain Silent" by Bruce Adolph on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
On the next alternative radio, hear a debate on anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, featuring Mehdi Hassan and Annett Wilf. That's Alternative Radio, Saturday evenings at 6, right here on 89.9 FM KUNM, KUNM.org, Albuquerque.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're taking your calls about what happens next with legal cannabis. Two bills are before the governor. She says she plans to sign them. Are you worried about legalization, or do you think this will help boost the state's economy? Give us a call at 277-5866 or email us at letstalk@kunm.org. I'm on the line with Andy Lyman, reporter with New Mexico Political Report, my co-host on the Growing Forward podcast, and Superintendent Linda Trujillo with the Regulation and Licensing Department. And Superintendent, I know you are busy because the clock is now ticking. What is the Regulation and Licensing Department working on to meet the deadlines under the legislation? What are those deadlines?
Yeah, there's some pretty heavy deadlines in there, Megan. And I did give my staff the weekend off, but we started up bright and early Monday morning, starting to get things organized. We've got to draft some rules. We've got to get those rules noticed. We've got to have the opportunity for the public to review those rules for at least 30 days. We'll have a public hearing where folks can make a comment, either written or verbal. We'll consider all of those comments. We'll make decisions, final decisions about the rules. They then have to be filed and then published by the New Mexico Register, by the New Mexico Administrative Law Division over at the State Records and Archives. All of that has to happen before September 1st. That's our first deadline, where we have to have the applications available no later than September 1st for producers. So that's when cannabis producers, the producer micro businesses, and the legacy cannabis producers, no later than that date, they'll have an opportunity to begin applying for production licenses with the department. And then the next date we move on to, that we've got the same process that we have to go through. The next date for everybody else to be licensed, begin licensing, is no later than January 1st of 2022. So there's a lot of work to be done between now and then.
And there are a number of licenses under this legislation. And so we've got, as you say, the producer's license. Could you briefly just address, you have a micro business license, which basically anyone can grow 6 plants for personal use, 12 plants per household. But if you want to do more than that, you have to get a micro business license, right?
So if you want to actually sell, so if you want to produce for sale, whether it's 1 or 2 or 6 plants, you're going to have a production license. You do have the ability to produce up to 6 plants for yourself personally, but you can't sell that to anybody, and you can't give it out, right? So if you're going to have a retail business, whether it's for the extract or for the edibles or just the cannabis, you're going to have a production license. And there's a couple different kinds of production licenses. There's the regular producer, and they can do, right now we don't have a limit identified. That's going to take us some time to figure out what that limit might be. So we're already in the process of beginning to get a contractor to help us do that analysis, to figure that out. But for a micro business producer, you could grow up to 200 plants. Any producer that's beyond the 200 plants is a regular producer, and they may have to pay up to $50 per plant for that production. So those are the two specific kinds of producers.
Okay. Also joining us is Moises Gonzalez. He's an assistant professor at the University of New Mexico and president of the Cañon de Cañoe Land Grant and co-editor of the recent book, Nación Genisera, Ethnogenesis, Place, and Identity in New Mexico. And Moises, you do not oppose the idea of legalization, but you raised concerns about the impact of legalization on rural New Mexico's traditional land-based communities during the regular session. With the bills that came out of the special session, do you feel these issues got addressed? What are you still concerned about?
I think during the special session, I think going into the 11th hour during the regular session, there was a lot of concerns. Paula Garcia with the New Mexico Aztec Association and a lot of us were making sure that there wasn't a negative impact to Aztecia land-grant-based communities. Also, the legislation was in such a way, we were tracking the micro-licenses a lot, and I know there was discussion whether 100 or 200 plants, and there was different conversations. But I think at the end of the day, on the show, I understand that Representative Lente shined in on rural issues and issues facing tribes, and Representative Garcia. I had raised concerns with a number of senators in the Albuquerque area. So I think all of us in this conversation can admit that not all interests got what they wanted, and that's the way legislation happens. Moving forward, what's critical are the rules that are being created, right? How are the negative impacts to rural, to Aztecia and land-grant-based communities? The biggest concern is how do water rights we already know that there's a sort of rural gentrification happening in the San Luis Valley in Alamosa.
In southern Colorado.
In Colorado, and that was kind of like an unseen consequence. So I think in this rule writing, we need to make sure, the Carnegie Land Grant, we have a brewery, we have a tap room that we run as a community. We thought that a micro license would be a good idea to expand our economic development. But the thing is, this is this catch, right? If you look at the rules, if it's driven by the industry and, the folks that already have the medical dispensary license, if they're the only ones writing the rules, it's not going to be fair. One of the things that happens in a lot of these states, based on what I've looked at, is a lot of rules are written in the sort of security concerns because of cannabis. And so there are certain regulations that almost allow people that have a law enforcement background to get into and security background to get into the business, whereas regular folks will have a hard time. So I'm just, the first thing we need to do is, these presentations, Secretary Linda Trujillo, you might be able to do some direct meetings with rural and land grant Aztecia based communities, and we could shine in on those rules because that's where it's going to need to be corrected, and so communities have a voice and can get into the. The big criticism is that people of color were criminalized for marijuana, and now just it's only corporations and. And it's kind of this continuancy of white supremacy that continues to now through a legal process that affects communities of color.
Will there be public input will be taken in the rulemaking process, Superintendent Trujillo, right?
That is correct. Yeah. Public comment has to be part of the rulemaking process. And one of the first bills that I passed in my first legislative session was the State Rules Act. So it's kind of one of those things that I'm kind of a nerd about.
Okay.
But public comment is absolutely one of the things that has to happen and will be considered.
Moises, just one more question for you before we let you go. But what would true equity look like for you and for land-grant communities?
I think true equity would be offset of the impact. So, in terms of water, looking at water rights transfers, looking at regulations on in terms of water use, and also in terms of those sort of protections. I think there has to be some mechanism of offsetting through the market. And I don't know, there might be some additional legislation that will have to be balanced out in the future. Because we, like I said, there's the unintended consequences like San Luis and in Alamosa. So we need, and I don't think the bill has, I mean, it talks about equity in there, but I don't know what how that exactly means and how that'll make it into the rules. The other thing is, the main important thing is not allowing the medical dispensaries and to write rules where it makes it impossible for the for small communities to get into it, into the business. What we see, I guess the what I like is the brewery and distillery license process is actually one where folks can get into. And if it wasn't for the brewery licenses, a lot of small rural communities would be completely dry, right? Because and I guess those alcohol rules were changed this last session. So what it means is equity in terms of not. I mean, we know Colorado that there's a whole lot of urban and rural gentrification. So we need to create policies that offset that impact. And we need to make sure that rules are set for rural communities to actually create economic development.
Okay, well, thank you. That's Moises Gonzalez. He is president of the Cañon de Carnoy Land Grant and assistant professor at the University of New Mexico. Thanks, Moises. We do have a quick call right now from Lee. Hi, Lee. Are you there?
My question was, the news keeps saying, like, the governor is expected to sign or she's set to sign. And I'm just wondering why she hasn't signed it already. Like, the legislation was finished a while ago. And if there's some kind of procedural delay, when is that over?
Well, I will kick that to our next guest, which is Democratic Representative Andrea Romero, who was one of the sponsors of the bill. Representative Romero, do you have some insight into that?
Yeah, we are hearing that it will likely be next week. So we got to save the date for Monday, sort of loosely, but it's still very fluid. And there is an administrative delay. You know, we did have a special session. So when you talk about bills, they go through a really, really thorough vetting process through the Legislative Counsel Service. So then the bill has to become sort of certified by everyone until it gets to the governor's desk. Also news to me, because I've never followed a bill so closely from start to finish as well. So I'm really grateful to be here now.
And Representative Romero, you heard some of the concerns that Moises Gonzalez raised. Do you feel that this version that finally came out after many years of trying addresses some of those issues?
I really do. You know, I've worked in entrepreneurship for a while, and the common sort of theme is the worry about gentrification. Are we targeting New Mexico homegrown businesses when we have subsidies, when we have abilities to serve, you know, our New Mexican people, and that's always a struggle. And so for what we have in this bill is very clearly stated, the intent, even for the committees that we have from a public health perspective or from an industry perspective, is really lasering in on how to create the vehicles, the avenues, the ways for being able to ensure that equity is part of our planning process, our production process, from really what we're calling seed to store, how that works. And so, you know, and being that we are so closely tied to this and have worked in the sort of negative consequences of seeing, you know, industry go away after we've rooted it into the state, you know, that those are some of the things that we really want to learn from. And of course, ensure that we do follow all the way through this process in New Mexico. And of course, his concerns are ours. I think we want to make sure that every single one of those folks who are in the state that want to be able to build into this business have the opportunity to do so.
And I know that your family's from rural northern New Mexico. The concerns about water and how do you see addressing those? And I know that the legislation sets up you have to have established water rights, but a lot of things can happen in the market around water, as he referred to in southern Colorado.
Totally and completely. You know, this is something that I actually worked on a separate bill this session. And water is very complicated in our state. And that was one of the sort of concerns that we've had throughout sort of new industries coming in that are big water users. One of the things that we did key in on quite a bit, because we did get the question about what is this crop going to take? And hearing from industry insiders, folks from Colorado and otherwise, and doing our own research, this cash crop requires a third of the water used for many of our major cash crops in the state, such as alfalfa, corn, some of our other large crops. So we're hopeful that in and of itself, it is less of a water guzzler than some of those crops. And of course, some of our bigger industries that use water like oil and gas. So the way we regulate water isn't by industry. And so it was sort of an unfair bent to have that against this one as we're getting it started up. So we definitely want to look at, I think, more broadly how we manage water in the state. And I would encourage all of our advocates to really dig under, dig into what's going on at with the water engineer's office. How do we manage water rights? How do we maintain them? How do we look at the future of our state from a bigger, broader perspective and how we look at water?
Are you interested in getting involved in a new legal recreational cannabis industry? What do you want to know about how this will work? You can call us now here on KUNM at 277-5866 or email us at letstalk@kunm.org. Representative Romero, the state will levy a 12% excise tax on the sale of cannabis. That eventually increases to 18%, but that's before standard taxes on sales take place, gross receipts of 5-9%. So now we're talking about a tax rate that's probably above what many consider the sweet spot, so to speak, of 20% to get people to not revert to the black market to buy cannabis. Why did it end up so high?
that's a great question. I think it's just a lot of how to figure out what the future looks like without really knowing what some of the crunching of the numbers on this, even thinking about a plant count or the perfect tax rate. Was just saying we know as much as we know to find what a sweet spot would be. The world is changing every single day. We're in the midst of a pandemic. What is the world going to look like next year, the year following? How do we create an equitable tax rate that will ensure that folks will be interested in this industry? We're not pricing them out of the market, but we're also ensuring that this is something that we are taxing that's to the benefit of New Mexicans. So for us, it is just above what we intended originally. But as we continue to look at GRT rates and try to fix our tax code in those ways as well, we're hoping that we find that right place. But again, not knowing what the market is, not knowing what the demand is, those are all of the things that we'll really wrestle with, I think, the first, 3 to 5 years in getting that equilibrium met. And so this will be something that I think we revisit quite often. And even in our bill within the special session, we created what they call a tax escalator. So it raises at 1% every single year after, I believe, the third or fifth year. So, we're trying to build in those systems to think about the future, but it without knowing what the market is today, it is very challenging indeed to really pin those down.
There are a lot of unanswered questions, of course. Interesting question. I should have asked this when we were talking about water, but an email from Neil says marijuana growing operations have a huge carbon footprint. Is there anything being done to address that critical problem as we face a climate crisis? That's just a small question for you.
Sure. Yeah, I think we can do that with a lot of incentives. We do in the bill talk about how the rules could be made to look at those offsets, look at how we encourage that kind of business building. So many companies are part of their brand now. So how can we incentivize those to brand that way and do that kind of business from a corporate social responsibility perspective? So I think there's a lot of opportunity in the rulemaking process to create those incentives. But now I think, we just want to do less than we can. And maybe part of it can just be repurposing soil, looking at regeneration and what we can do to build it into the business itself.
Well, I appreciate you joining us this morning, Representative Romero. And we need to go to a quick break. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, back in a minute.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA. In times of crisis, something seemingly small, like the lack of contraceptives, can have long-lasting consequences for women. We travel to the Colombia-Venezuela border to see what this looks like.
The women who were denied the abortion saw serious financial issues that end up in the court system.
That's next time on Latino USA.
That's Latino USA, Monday mornings at 8 a.m. on KUNM. The pandemic has taken a toll on one of Native America's leading economic development sources. But don't count cultural tourism and gaming out just yet. Native tourism experts and tribal officials are responding with creative solutions to keep their economies going. We'll check in on tribal tourism on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. What are you curious about how now that recreational cannabis will likely be legal in New Mexico, and how should we make sure the benefits of the industry will be equitable? There's still time to call this morning at 277-5866. You can also email us at letstalk@kunm.org. I'm going to take a call from George. You had a question about water usage, George, from Albuquerque.
Yeah, so I had just a quick comment about water usage. My main question is about how marginalized communities can possibly get a foot in the door, especially since people who were convicted of selling marijuana in the past, you know, will not be allowed to participate in an industry that they have actual training in, which I think is very unfair, and it's a kick in the face to people like that.
Okay, let me kick that question to Superintendent Trujillo, because I think actually people will be able to participate even though they've had past convictions, correct?
That is correct, Megan. So the law as it's written, because we've got the expungement, that's one area that's going to benefit individuals who have been convicted of marijuana crimes in the past. But the law actually says that the department shall not solely consider a conviction of a crime for substance, either possession, trafficking, or you know, any other kind of crime. That cannot be the sole reason for denying a license. And the conviction of cannabis in and of itself cannot be considered at all.
And the Regulation and Licensing Department will be the main oversight body. And you can go to, there's already a portal up, the cannabis, what is it called? The Cannabis Oversight Commission?
It's the Cannabis Control Division.
And we have a link to that on our website at KUNM.org under the show post. You're, in terms of water, you will be working across agencies, agriculture, environment, correct? So
That is correct. We'll be working across the not only environment and agriculture, Department of Health, of course, because they've been the main party overseeing the medical cannabis. But we also have to work with the state engineer. We'll be working with local communities. We're in the process of adding a link on our website that we've put up the day after the bill was passed to tell local communities what they can and can't do. So, yeah, we'll be working very closely with communities outside. We also have already reached out to the Economic Development Department and have a resource guide for small businesses. It's a pretty comprehensive guide that tells how you can get licensing, not for cannabis, but for just business licensing, because you're still going to have to take care of the local business responsibilities like a tax number with the IRS, a tax number with the state, a business license with either your municipality or the county. So it's a pretty comprehensive guide on step-by-step for small businesses.
We have another call from Judy in Albuquerque. Judy, what is your question? Are you there, Judy?
Hi. I'm wondering if there's any way for the police to determine how much marijuana is in a person's blood if there's a highway infraction.
Well, actually, your question is a good one to bring up because I'm joined now by Democratic Representative Derek Lente. And Representative Lente, you are a Democrat, and this vote on cannabis fell mostly on party lines, but you voted against it. And I believe partly because you have some concerns like this around criminal justice issues.
Ms. Cameron, good morning. Thank you for having me this morning. You know, I am a proud Democrat, and I hate to be known as the Democrat that's the wet towel on a quote-unquote Democratic bill. But at the same time, I think it's important to note that I represent a large portion of Native American New Mexico. That includes seven pueblos, the Hickory Apache Nation, and several chapters of the Navajo Nation. And as large and diverse as New Mexico is, Sometimes not all Democrats are rank and file, and so we have to make sure that we represent the people that sent us to Santa Fe. And so with this, there was a large concern in regards to, I think, what Mr. Gonzalez before me mentioned were the unintended consequences of if a piece of legislation like this passes. What might that mean for those folks that live on tribal lands or federal lands in the state of New Mexico? And so when people talk about, well, I voted with the Republicans, perhaps they voted with me, or perhaps they voted with us, or perhaps we see things differently as in regards to that. Again, this state being as large and diverse as it is, there are very many facets of this state. So when I talk about matters and when I talked about matters in debate on the House floor, respectfully, I mentioned to the sponsors, both Representative Martinez and Representative Romero, that I love dearly and that we're really great friends, that we check our personal concerns at the door and we talk about policy as it relates to the people that we represent. And so with those concerns is to the point that jurisdictional matters, that, you know, if it's fair now on state lands, but it's still a controlled one substance on federal and tribal lands, what does that mean for the tribal members that now feel that it's safe, for instance, to go to Albuquerque, buy a substance and bring it back then to the Pueblo or the tribal or the reservation, and then now be caught in now with something that is a controlled and illegal substance on federal lands? And so when those types of issues come up, it brings to mind matters of unfairness in criminal law where it treats people of color unjustly. So what is minor now, what will be minor now in state jurisdiction is then still a federal crime on federal land, a major crime on federal land, when federal laws are applied. And so for matters related to many of the people that I represent, they again are then, it perpetuates the aspect of Native Americans being punished more severely, higher penalties, longer sentences, and the list can go on and on and on. And so with those issues that were brought to light, I still don't think that we have a clear identification of how these issues will be handled in this greater scheme of when this piece of legislation is finalized or when it will go into effect.
And
furthermore,
and I just wanted to bring up her question about the detecting the amount of marijuana. It's like for your law enforcement, you can detect if someone's driving impaired under alcohol. You cannot. There's no way to detect a level, right?
There is no way to detect a level as I understand it. And so that was a concern that many of the tribal police brought to my attention, is that it is going to have to be done through blood tests. And how is that going to be done? And who's going to pay for that? And how are we going to be educated on how this is going to be done? So I think there are a lot of loose ends yet to be tied up. Furthermore, in regards to the tribal aspect of it all, employment, tribal entities have become large employers in our state today. And so many of them still have questions of, well, how does this impact us? And no one has talked to us about how we will be having to regulate matters of a controlled substance that is now legal on state lands, but in tribal areas, it is still very much an illegal substance. So the list can go on and on and on. And so I think for a matter of the people I represent, it's a matter of, you know, when issues of this come to light and come to fruition, we need to be made sure that we are a part of the discussions early on, so that we have our issues clarified, so that if this is something that's going to be good for all of the people of the state of Mexico, we could be a large supporter as opposed to people that have great concern in regards to these types of issues.
Do you foresee being able to address some of these in the rulemaking process that Superintendent Trujillo will be overseeing?
Ms. Cambridge, I do believe that some of these issues will have to be addressed in the rulemaking sessions, because if not, then we are going to have a large unregulated and to the point of many of the people, specifically that of the Navajo Nation, there's going to be large mentions of black market illicit substance abuse and selling on reservation lands, which I don't think any of us want to have happen in our state today.
We do have one final guest, and I will note that Representative Lente voted against the cannabis legalization bill, but you voted for the separate bill on expungement. And our final guest is Kim Chavez-Cook. She is with the Law Office of the Public Defender. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Why were expungements for cannabis offenses something you and other public defenders saw as necessary for legalization?
Sure. So I think really it's just about equity and making sure that the communities in our state that have been already negatively impacted by the criminalization of cannabis possession are put on equal footing with the folks going forward who will now be able to do the exact same thing without any criminal repercussions. And so it's sort of just a fundamental fairness and equity piece, and is in the nationwide discussions of legalizing recreational cannabis is one of the really sort of high priorities for the criminal defense community, because otherwise our former clients are sort of placed in a you know, lesser position if they are still suffering the collateral consequences or incarceration for something that is now legal.
You had something you wanted to add, Andy.
I thought Kim was a good person to sort of address this issue that keeps coming up about levels of intoxication, right? Everyone thinks of this sort of idea that we do have sort of a, I would argue, so almost an arbitrary number that says this is how much alcohol you can have in your system and still drive. But I think the public defender's office is a good source to talk about sort of how this is already happening with other substances that can't be measured.
That is true. Kim, did you want to add anything to that?
Sure, I'm happy to address it briefly. The truth is that even when cannabis was illegal, it was also illegal to drive while under the influence of THC. And so we had systems in place for determining that. The law enforcement agencies around the state typically use someone called a DRE, a drug recognition expert, to conduct those kinds of investigations to determine through sort of field sobriety tests, roadside field sobriety tests, and other things like that, to determine if someone's reflexes and balance and reaction times and things like that are affected by anything that's in their system. And so that kind of evidence remains admissible in court. There's also the ability, even though we haven't set a per se amount of THC in blood levels, because the scientific consensus does not exist to say that there is a per se amount that means that most people at this level would be impaired. The science supports that for alcohol, but not for cannabis or THC. And but there is a way to say, well, if they have this level and you bring in an expert to talk about that level combined with the observations at the scene to be able to prove up a case. So it's not impossible to establish someone's impairment under without that per se level being set. And we have concerns about a per se level since it's not really indicative of most people's impairment level.
We don't have much time left, so I do want to get to, I know this is complicated, Kim, but how will expungements work under this bill?
Absolutely. So the really bare bones of it is that it's automatic. It's designed to not require anybody with a previous conviction to have to take any action, although they can. It allows for that if someone wants to sort of get at the front of the line, or if they feel like it's just taking too long for their case to make it to the court, they can petition to have their case reviewed. But otherwise, it should all happen automatically. So the expungement for old cannabis offenses is an automatic process. The records are supposed to be expunged 2 years after the date of conviction automatically. And then for more recent convictions where someone is maybe still serving a sentence for a cannabis conviction, either in prison or in a county jail, because a misdemeanor sentence can be served in jail, the facility that's holding them has 30 days after the effective date of the bill, which will be in July sometime, depending on when the governor signs it. And then 30 days after that, so sometime in August, the corrections department and jails have to start notifying the court, we're holding this person on a cannabis offense, we're holding that person on a cannabis offense. And then the court is obligated at that point to reopen those cases. And if it's now something that is not a crime at all, they have to dismiss it and expunge it. And if it is now a lesser offense, some like a penalty assessment misdemeanor, where all they're supposed to do is pay a fine, then they are to redesignate that offense offense as a penalty assessment misdemeanor. And then after that process starts to happen, which should start also happening through DPS, the Department of Public Safety, starting in January of 2022, they're supposed to evaluate all public records and identify all the cases eligible for reopening and expungement. And then DAs, prosecutors, have until July 2022 to challenge particular cases and say, well, we don't think this one qualifies, and let all the others through. And then the court process will take, will begin basically in July 1 for all of those cases of next year. So I would estimate by the end of 2022, most cases will have been at least identified and be in the court system, if not already resolved. But the Supreme Court will also have to promulgate some rules for how that court process will look exactly. And so they may set some timelines that'll give us a better sense of how long it'll all take.
According to the Santa Fe Reporter, it looks like more than 150,000 people would be eligible for automatic expungement under this bill. That's far more than the estimates that came up when the bill was being debated. Are we going to be able to do this? This can be on the Department of Public Safety.
Yeah, we'll be able to do it eventually is the reality. So the bill does not set a deadline for when it all has to be completed. And so ultimately, I think my only concern is that things will languish so long that people will have to start nudging their cases along. But I do think it'll be possible to get it done eventually. It just might take a while. And my hope is they'll prioritize the people who are currently still under a sentence, so that their cases get resolved first, and someone who has an old cannabis conviction from the 80s can maybe wait a couple extra months to have their case expunged. Although, you know, if someone is waiting for licensure for a professional job, or is submitting a job application now where that old conviction is actually a barrier to them actively now, then that petition provision in the bill that allows them to sort of jump the line if they have a good reason to would allow those folks to sort of get that front-end detention.
We are almost done, but I have a quick question I hope you can answer from someone who mailed from Sam. If a landlord has a no drugs clause in their lease, is that still enforceable for marijuana?
That is a great question. So, you know, I think that's going to have to be determined. The Cannabis Regulation Act, and this wouldn't be affected by the expungement bill, but by the other larger bill, that does say that there are a number of areas that people cannot suffer consequences because of cannabis, complying with the Cannabis Regulation Act. So if someone is in possession legally, they can't be denied public assistance, for example. So whether or not privately negotiated contracts would fall within the scope of that, At first blush, I would say probably a landlord in a privately negotiated contract can still include that clause, but there may be litigation in our future.
Wow. Yes, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of things future around this. There's a lot to work out. Superintendent Trujillo, I'm sure you and your staff will probably not be taking summer vacations. So
thank you, Megan. I jokingly have said everybody's going to know what I did for the summer.
As you work out some of these things. Well, that is just about all the time we have today. I want to thank everyone who called in, and I'm sorry we didn't get to all the calls. We appreciate you sharing your thoughts, and thank you so much to all of our guests, Andy Lyman, my co-host on the Growing Forward podcast, Regulation and Licensing Superintendent Linda Trujillo, State Representatives Andrea Romero and Derek Lente, and Moises Gonzalez and Kim Chavez Cook. Thank you all so much. Let's keep the conversation going. You can share your thoughts on Twitter with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. On Facebook, search for KUNM Radio, or email letstalk@kunm.org. If you missed part of the show, you can stream it online or subscribe to our podcast. You can find it wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Our engineer today is Marino Spencer. Taylor Velasquez screened your calls, and Ty Bannerman produced the show. I'm Megan Kamrick. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. This is 89.9 KUNM and KUNM HD, Albuquerque, Santa Fe, live from the University of New Mexico. Also broadcasting on KRRT, Arroyo Seco, KRRE, Las Vegas, KRAR, Española, and KBOM, Socorro, with translators K220EM, Nyeezy, K220AV, Taos, K213ET, Eagle Nest, and K216CU, Cuba, online at KUNM.org.